Australia, the island continent of the south, with a relatively small population, has more natural resources at its disposal per capita than any other nation on the face of the earth. As a young country, with little more than a 200-year history since the first white settlement, Australia is a treasure trove of mineral and agricultural resources. Its place as a wool producer is legendary. The Jumbuck is more than the contents of a swagman's tucker bag. Australia's formative years were literally built on the sheep's back. Australia, in many years, is ranked as the biggest exporter of beef in the world, and is one of the few nations capable of producing a ton of wheat for everyone, young and old, in its community. Its coal, oil shale, iron ore, copper, lead, silver, and gold deposits are a byword. Kalgoorlie's Golden Mile has its counterpart across the face of Australia. Australia's cane industry, producing sugar for both export and local consumption, extends through an unbroken coastal strip of 2,000 kilometres along its eastern seaboard. The infrastructure to utilise these advantages has long been in place. Industries have functioned prodigiously in both war and peace. As one nation within an island continent, one of the few nations in the world that has no common border with another, Australia has, until recently, avoided the border tensions which have beset less fortunate nations. With so many advantages, Australia surely should be a contented, prosperous, and well-defended nation, offering incentive and hope to its youth, and material security and serenity to those in retirement. Quality home ownership should be within the reach of all. Crime should be almost non-existent. Material security should provide a base on which a wide range of artistic and cultural achievements should blossom. Australia instead has become increasingly the prey of many forces, among them social and political confusion and the debt merchants. The legal system is a morass of conflicting rules and regulations, increased day by day by its various tiers of government. Its constitutional foundations are being deliberately eroded. Its industries, both rural and manufacturing, are being depleted. Crime is at an all-time high. Poverty is widespread. The defence system is almost non-existent. And domestic and foreign debt are high, even by third world standards. The principles on which the nation was founded over 200 years ago are little understood and seldom taught to the children. Let us analyse in a little more detail the nature of what is happening. Australia's constitution, with which it ventured into nationhood at the end of the 19th century, provided for a federation with a division of powers. The original states, each of which had already developed functional parliaments within a constitutional framework, agreed to cede a number of their own powers to a new national government. An upper house, the Senate, was established with the specific task of defending the states against encroachments exceeding the limit of those powers to be transferred. The head of state was the Crown, whose role was to keep intact the historical lessons of the importance of divided and limited powers, such as an independent judiciary, a police and military which was not simply at the mercy of politicians, and above all, the reserve power to dissolve any parliament which flouted the constitution, accepted by the people. The judiciary itself was to be headed by a new high court, not to replace the separate judicial system already functioning in each state, but to make judgments on the national laws and any areas where a conflict between the states and the federal government might occur. Included in its duties was the task of interpreting the federal constitution exactly as framed. Unique in the provisions of the Commonwealth Government constitution was the amending formula, a provision that changes could only be made through a national referendum, in which a majority of Australians in a majority of states was necessary to effect change. In this way, the smaller states were intended to have some protection against bigger populations in bigger states or cities. The provision for change by referendum contrasted favourably with Canada, where no agreement on an amending formula was achieved for over 100 years, and New Zealand, which has no written constitution. The right and responsibility of Australians to be consulted in the stipulated manner about constitutional changes has now been dangerously damaged. The mechanism for this dangerous corruption of our constitution has been a radical interpretation by the High Court of two words in the document itself, namely external affairs, a power given to the new Commonwealth government at the time of federation in section 51(29). Colin Howard, the professor of law at the University of Melbourne, wrote in August 1988, quote, "The legislative power of section 51(29) was included in the constitution to enable the national government to deal with other national governments on matters of legitimate national concern which arose in the international arena. It has been turned into an instrument of domestic political coercion, manifesting contrary to both word and the spirit of the very constitution in which it appears." End of quote. What is behind this enormous change? A change which is increasingly and effectively disenfranchising the Australian people. Professor Howard summarises it thus, quote, "The essence of the problem has been that the end of the Second World War in 1945 heralded in the ushering of an era of unparalleled internationalism in the conduct of world affairs and in governmental regulation of domestic affairs. Successive Australian governments have responded to these developments like governments elsewhere by entering into an enormously increased number of international agreements or understandings and assuming international obligations in unprecedented abundance. Many of these arrangements, which for convenience can be collectively called treaties, although many of them are not, strictly speaking, treaties at all in the traditional sense, purport to require the signatories to make significant changes to the way they have traditionally run things in their own countries." End of quote. Put into simple terms, for those unfamiliar with these matters and at the risk of putting some legal niceties aside, the blunt facts go something like this. If the Commonwealth government signed and passed into law a treaty with another country or countries which undertook to, firstly, ensure that all nations had only one central police force to fight crime the better, and secondly, establish in each nation only one central education system in order to educate children in the need for global peace and world control, then the very next day, all state police forces and state schools would be illegal, and their abolition or transfer to central control would follow. No referendum is necessary. The people are not consulted. It requires only legislation to this effect to pass through the federal parliament. It doesn't matter if the other signatory is the late Mr. Idi Amin of Uganda, or a nation you can't even find on the map. It doesn't matter if the other nation doesn't even fulfill the agreement within its own territories. All that matters is what a majority on the full bench of the High Court says. There is now no higher legal authority available to which to appeal. So what the High Court judges decide is final, and that is that. Appeals to the Privy Council have now been abolished. If the High Court finds that a treaty exists, and the treaty requires that the Commonwealth takes over all schools and takes control of all police, then, as the Commonwealth has been legally given the right to use external affairs as a means of increasing its own power, despite the rest of the Constitution, through resorting to international treaties, however dubious or unwanted by the people, it can assume total control over police or schools or any other matter it wishes. But, you say, what if the Constitution actually leaves control over police and schools in the hands of the states, at least until such a time as the Australian people have had a referendum on the matter. Well, that would be irrelevant and overruled. As simple as that. If you have any doubts, let me quote you section 100 of the Constitution. Quote, "The Commonwealth shall not, by any law or regulation of trade or commerce, abridge the right of a state or of the residents therein to the reasonable use of the waters of rivers for conservation or irrigation." End of quote. In the widely publicized Franklin Dam case, whatever the rights or wrongs of the plan to dam the Franklin River, the High Court set aside this simple wording, transferring the power over rivers to the Commonwealth government, on the basis that it was covered by an international treaty. The law is now the exact opposite of what the Constitution says it is, even though the original wording remains the same, because no referendum of the Australian people has been held on the issue. What has, in fact, been destroyed is the intention, the very meaning of the Constitution in Section 100. The same destruction can obviously be applied wherever some international agreement can be used for such a purpose. The only people who can change this dangerous state of affairs are four of the seven High Court judges, or a federal government courageous and honest enough to call a referendum to stop this international intrusion into Australia's constitutional matters without the people's consent. However, as it is the Commonwealth government which is the beneficiary of this power transfer, and it alone appoints High Court judges, and alone initiates such referendums as it deems necessary, such chances are less than Buckley's. Thus, Australians have lost control over the direction of their constitution. There is no doubt that all federal governments want to increase their own powers. If there is any check at all to this process of power centralization, it is simply that politicians tend to be careful of moving fast enough to provoke wide reaction, which could jeopardize success at future elections. Nevertheless, this continuing challenge must finally destroy the Constitution as a whole, unless some challenge to the radical misuse of external affairs can be mounted. The only question at the moment is that of speed. One of the significant High Court cases which led to this state of affairs, the Kuwata case, Justice Wilson commented, quote, "It is no exaggeration to say that what is emerging is a sophisticated network of international arrangements directed to the personal, economic, social, and cultural development of all human beings. The effect of investing the Commonwealth Parliament with this power through Section 5129 in all these areas would be the transfer to the Commonwealth of virtually unlimited power in almost every conceivable aspect of life in Australia, including health and hospitals, the workplace, law and order, education and recreational and cultural activities, to mention but a few general heads." End of quote. What does all this mean? Simply that the major changes affecting Australia's national life are no longer made with the assent of the Australian people, but in conformity with an international creed which in many ways may be quite alien to Australia's history and traditions, culture and customs, and even our national sovereignty and freedoms. Australians urgently need to be consulted on two clear alternatives. One, do we consent to this drift in international lawmaking, ultimately into some form of international government? Or two, do we want to maintain Australian sovereignty, with the freedom to cooperate with other nations for mutual benefit, where and for the period that the citizens consent? All graduates and Australians generally must confront this choice. The true role of law must be maintained. or tyranny results. Australia has three tiers of law-making bodies: the National Parliament, the various state governments, and our local shires and municipalities. The necessity for law and law enforcement has been one of the most teasing problems facing civilizations throughout history. It is possible, as evidenced by countless examples, to produce so many laws with so much force behind them that free choice for the individual becomes narrower and is finally eliminated. Life from there on is one of obedience, conformity, and misery. On the other hand, the absence of law would result in anarchy, and then to another form of despotism, the law of the jungle and the survival of the fittest. The narrow path between these two extremes is hard to find, harder to maintain, and has never been possible without a generally accepted set of principles being acknowledged by those living under the law. In Australia's case, the principles were contained in the aforementioned Constitution. The ensuing law-making process should have been slow and cautious, enacted no faster than the ability of the community to comprehend, assess, and accept the process. In fact, this was roughly the case in Australia's early history. From 1901 to 1905, the Commonwealth Parliament passed an average of 20 acts per year. This meant that each member of Parliament could read each bill for himself, totally impossible now, take it home, and seek the views of people in his electorate before finally voting on it in Parliament. By the 1970s, the same Parliament was passing over 200 bills each year, and the average now is between 200 and 300. There is not one member of Parliament capable of reading the bills voted on, let alone consulting his electorate prior to that vote. In addition, government by regulation has become standard practice. This is done by what is called enabling legislation, a bill placed before Parliament which contains a proviso allowing a government agency or authority to include regulations after it has been passed by the Parliament. The department or agency concerned can, therefore, include a whole number of regulations, fines, penalties, and other requirements which carry the full force of the law, but which have not actually been before Parliament itself. Often these regulations require such things as forms and applications to be filled in, the right to enter private property without the traditional magistrate's warrant, and even clauses which exempt the department from any legal action by a citizen whose rights may have been abused. The result is that Australia is estimated to have over 3 million laws and regulations, although no one has ever sat down and counted them. Whatever the figure, this hugely excessive number is being increased by an average 2 Acts of Parliament and 5 regulations every 24 hours. Only a fraction of these is ever cited by individual members of Parliament, who are often caught unawares and genuinely surprised when informed of the bills they themselves are accorded to have voted on. This in turn generates the expansion of a new type of industry, a costly addition to businesses and industry, whose sole occupation is checking and complying with government regulations. As far back as 1984, the multiplication of laws was ridiculous. Australia's major weekly, The Bulletin, reported in April that year as follows, quote, "During the 1970s, all government expenditure grew by 298%, against 132% in the private sector. During the same period, all government employment grew in spite of employment ceilings by 26%, against 1.4% in the private sector. In the past 20 years, 1964 to 1984, federal and state governments have passed 16,631 Acts of Parliament, and no fewer than 32,551 regulations. The federal government has an estimated 12,500 public servants engaged full-time in regulating business. By contrast, it was estimated in business that 54,000 employees were engaged last year in dealing with federal and state governments' regulations, at a cost of $3,720 million. Put another way, out of every dollar of net income earned by business, 13 cents was spent in complying with federal and state laws. End of quote. Now, what does this mean? Simply that the old belief that ignorance of the law was neither excuse nor defense has become a monstrous cynicism. For not one person in Australia knows all the laws and regulations that exist. Yet no party or government has ever had a policy of repealing unnecessary laws, rather than increasing the already untenable burden. What about industry? A backward glance over a 20-year period from the Australia in the early 90s reveals an ominous situation. Over a 20-year period from 1972 to 1992, almost 130,000 farmers were forced off the land, many in dire circumstances. By the beginning of 1993, it was reported that 70% of the remaining primary producers were technically bankrupt. On the last day of 1992, December the 31st, the Australian reported in the following terms, quote, "The traditional family farm has been the backbone of Australian agriculture since the colonial days, the family unit working hard together and passing on the birthright from father to son. But after almost 200 years of various hardships and disasters, the economic realities of the past two decades have finally killed it off. The family farm is still upright, but it's dead on its feet." End of quote. Over the same period, Australia has lost approximately 50% of its manufacturing industries. The majority have gone into liquidation. Hundreds more have moved offshore. Government leaders, responsible for the gross over-regulation and overtaxing of industries, have berated those still struggling to survive with lack of efficiency. Inevitably, what has been referred to in one best-selling book as Australia's shutdown has resulted in a huge leap in unemployment, with as many as 1 million officially unemployed, and the unofficial figure estimated to be much higher. A brief summary of the Australian condition, which was published in Commonwealth for the Common Good, a report issued by the Catholic Church at the end of 1992, after 2 years' research, highlighted the following somber statistics. Over 680,000 children live in homes in which no one had an income-producing job. Australia had an estimated 25,000 children who were homeless. For people on average incomes, the real cost of buying a first home doubled in the 5 years to 1988. Nearly 250,000 Australians were on waiting lists for houses. 2 out of 3 Australians owed more than they owned. A review of the factors leading to this grim state of affairs leads inevitably towards the issue of finance and financial policy. And the biggest growth industry in the financial world is that of debt. While there are numerous areas when it comes to debt analysis, for the purpose of a general picture, we need only cover 3 main categories: public debt, private debt, and that aspect of these first two which leads to foreign debt, the money owed by Australians to overseas lenders. The debts of the Commonwealth and states in Australia is approximately doubling every decade. For example, national debt. Commonwealth and states, 1969, 12.5 billion. 1979, 31.1 billion. 1989, 59.2 billion. Taking 1969 as a base, there has been a 500% growth in public debt in the following 20 years. But this is not an accurate picture. Many semi-government authorities, which in 1969 drew their funding from government sources, have 20 years later been authorized to borrow their own money, now listed under private debt. When it comes to taxation, the figures are startling. Adding together the total direct and indirect taxation levied by Commonwealth and state governments in Australia, the results look like this. Total Commonwealth and states direct and indirect taxation, 1969, $7.3 billion, or $635 per head of population. That is $2,540 for father, mother and two children. 1979, $28.1 billion, or $1,930 per head of population. That is $7,720 for father, mother and two children. 1989, $111.6 billion, or $6,560 per head of population. That is $26,240 for father, mother and two children. Whereas in 1969, each Australian paid an average $635 in taxation for both Commonwealth and state revenue, in 1989, 20 years later, each Australian was paying just under $1,000 in interest alone on government debt. Apart from what governments have borrowed on behalf of Australians, the total private sector debt by 1989 had reached $458 billion, or $27,000 per head of population. That is $108,000 for the average family of four. The most serious part of this debt is the $165 billion net debt now owed by Australians to overseas lenders, which, through the first 2 years of the 90s, grew by an average $2 million every 60 minutes. Sooner than tackling this savage debt and tax growth, now crippling Australia's industries, as we have seen, the various governments, mainly the Commonwealth, have been trying to hide the reality of what is happening by another dangerous and potentially destructive policy, that of selling increasing portions of Australia itself into foreign ownership. The excuse given is that Australia has been importing more than it exports, although the reasons why this is so are generally evaded. Of Australia's total export income in 1989, for example, over 60% was required to service foreign debt. We won't seek to catalogue all the latest dispatches from this front, but we will evidence the trends. By 1972, the former Liberal Member of Parliament, Mr. Edward St. John, QC, who had an interest in this issue, gave these figures in the Sydney Morning Herald on January the 19th. Quote, degree of foreign ownership in selected manufacturing industries, 1966. Motor vehicle construction and assembly, 88.7%. Non-ferrous metals, rolling and extrusion, 83.6%. Soap and candles, 82%. Mineral oils refining, 81.6%. Industrial heavy chemicals and acids, 78%. Pharmaceuticals and toilet preparations, 76.3%. End of quote. As we moved into the 80s, the National Times, July the 4th, 1981, in a six-page major feature on foreign ownership, stated, quote, Australian manufacturing industry is about 40% controlled by overseas interests, and the percentage is rising. In 1981, Australia is second only to Canada among the developed countries in terms of foreign control over its industrial sectors. Amid the present claims of the benefits which massive new foreign investments will bring, Australia has already reached the point where each financial year, in fact, produces a net outflow of funds in income payable overseas. End of quote. Since then, the pace of foreign investment has been stepped up enormously, fired by an addiction to foreign capital as a means of masking the debt crisis. The increase in Japanese investment over 1 5-year period was staggering. In 1982, it was 5.4 billion. In 1987, it was 21.3 billion. By November 1992, a major feature in the West Australian gave these stark figures. Quote, overseas ownership in Australia has doubled over the preceding 5 years, with a portfolio now worth $300 billion each year, buying Australian businesses and assets. This is increased by an average $20 billion each year, buying Australian businesses and assets. Apart from industry, 60% of metropolitan newspapers are foreign-owned. National and state dailies are dominated by such international giants as News Limited and the Hollinger Group. News Limited, for instance, headed by Rupert Murdoch, owns a portfolio of over 120 Australian companies engaged in newspapers, television, film, video production, book publishing, or printing. As Australian-owned enterprises have fallen before the onslaught of foreign ownership, 70% of the merchandise on the nation's shelves are produced by foreign-owned businesses, whether domiciled in Australia or overseas. By the end of 1992, the average number of applications to the Foreign Investment Review Board exceeded 3,000, of which more than 97% were accepted. Of these, 2,000 were for real estate. By the same time, 10% of Australia was foreign-owned. This huge influx of foreign capital has not reduced the nation's debt structure or produced the prosperity promised to us by its advocates in all parties in the 60s. Rather, it has simply taken Australia's profits out of the hands of Australians, placing them into foreign balance sheets. Sooner than face the realities of debt, the perpetual demand for more foreign money has become part of governmental procedure, never questioned or challenged. Government itself has joined the auction sale with the currently fashionable policy of privatization. This simply means transferring long-established government instrumentalities, banks, railways, trams, electricity commissions, airways, gas corporations, and utilities, not into Australian private enterprise, but into multinational ownership. Writing on this subject in November 1992, well-known Australian commentator B.A. Santamaria asked the question which no political party has dared face. Quote, are we really to believe that the world's most acute financial minds have finished up in the highly advantageous position of exchanging book entries for real assets by the purest accident, without a modicum of pre-planning? Somehow, it is hard to believe. End of quote. Going on to the debts which have led to this pitiful national action of Australia itself, Mr. Santamaria made this point, quote, to believe that these vast sums, escalating astronomically through compound interest, will ever be repaid is the purest fantasy. But while they remain on the books, they furnish a useful formula for the transfer of real assets, public utilities of every type, from debtors to creditors. End of quote. And he made this all-important point. Quote, why don't we stop kidding ourselves? Except that compound interest, or usury, is the heart of the worldwide problem. And that unless we can devise a financial system on a new and different basis, we are all equally lost. End of quote. Are there answers to this vital proposition? Students attending this seminar will be presented with some challenging alternatives, which will stretch the limits of imagination later on. Education is the transmission belt for truth and experience. It is widely believed that education systems in Australia are failing to deliver mature, well-informed and literate school leavers. The debate between educators and industry leaders has raged for years. Typical amongst many was a report in The Australian in August 1985. Quote, "The chairman of James Hardie Industries, Mr. John Reed, said yesterday, when young people were employed in the industry, the organizations had to teach them to read and write and do simple arithmetic. Mr. Reed claimed the quality of English usage was poor and there was an inability to write coherently." End of quote. Mr. Reed was subsequently attacked by state education authorities, but many other industry leaders supported what he was saying. The tragic end result was described by one of Australia's leading educators, Dame Leonie Kramer, writing in The Australian on April the 13th, 1992. Quote, "Several years ago, a survey showed that 87% of young people did not know we had a constitution. That must have surprised only those who were unaware of the extent to which educational policymakers in the 1970s had succeeded in substituting uninformed opinion about social and political matters for the knowledge of how the system works. There is now a growing recognition that young people need to be taught the basic facts about how we govern ourselves, though even this will not necessarily immunize them against skepticism about politics, especially if they visit Parliament on one of its bad days." End of quote. The survey referred to by Dame Leonie Kramer was described in The Australian of March the 9th, 1989, in which it was shown that 46% of the whole nation did not know of the existence of the Constitution. The figure was much higher among young people, reflecting the failure of the education system to inform them properly. The survey added, quote, "Only 60% can name one House of Parliament, while one in five people cannot name either." As a result of the findings of a Senate committee report, Education for Active Leadership, senators warned yesterday that democracy was under threat because of widespread political ignorance. End of quote. So what does this mean? Surely that a population which has never been taught even the fundamentals of its own heritage and institutions is in no position to defend itself when those institutions come under attack. What about defence? Australia, whose wartime record is second to none, has depleted the nation's defence system to low levels. By the end of 1987, The Australian reported the then Shadow Minister for Defence, Mr. Peter White, a former battalion commander, pointing out in Parliament some of the warnings that have been sounded by almost every senior service chief over the years. Quote, "Frontline units were operating at half strength. The Navy could neither attract nor retain technicians. 88% of all naval officers were considering resignation. In the Air Force, Australia was losing pilots twice as fast as they could be replaced, with 300 expected to leave that year." End of quote. At the time Mr. White was speaking, just under half the Australian armed forces had left the services in the previous 4 years. By January 1989, Mr. Santamaria wrote in The Australian, quote, "Should the necessity arise, Australia could not maintain two battalions in continuous operation for a period of 2 months." End of quote. Although desultory attempts were made to bolster a sagging defence force in the early 90s by additional spending on planes and submarines, the traditional idea of Army, Navy and Air Force chiefs in direct contact with their forces, making the required decisions, has given way to another massive bureaucracy. A report in the Financial Review on October the 24th, 1991, summed up the situation. Quote, "More officers were leading less troops in the shrinking Australian Defence Force. The ADF has one of the highest ratios of officers to other ranks of any military force in the world." Lieutenant Commander Alan Hinge warned, "Commissions are increasingly given away on the basis of commercial and bureaucratic criteria." End of quote. What does this mean? Simply that as the best insurance of peace is a strong and viable armed service, Australia is tragically underinsured. A growing number of Australians now feel that something is seriously wrong, without necessarily being able to articulate all the details. Many are instinctively uneasy that our nation is in trouble. This feeling of unease and apprehension, however, is of no effect unless it is given a constructive means of expressing itself in a way that halts the deterioration and initiates a return to freedom. Great changes never start amongst those in power, but through ordinary citizens, men and women, who have had enough. So the stage is set for constructive change. But change cannot be made without informed citizens in the electorate itself. Leadership from a service-committed citizenry must be fostered and encouraged, and then motivated, if Australia is to realise its wonderful potential for abundance and freedom.